On the Nature of Sufi Knowledge, a lecture by Idris Shah, delivered in 1976 before a live audience.
Living in the West, I have noticed for many years that it's not so much a difficulty of communication to get over our point of view, the way we study things, how we think, what we want you to know. It is that we very often have different assumptions. And these assumptions tend to inhibit the learning process or the ideas transmission process. At the risk of being thought that I'm trying to wring a cheap laugh out of you, I feel I really must share with you something which happened to me in New York on the way in here. At another symposium which we had, I had given one talk and I was staying in the hotel where the symposium was held, and I was in fact leaving my room on the way to the lecture hall, when somebody wearing one of these badges that they give you, which proves that you're in the thing, came up to me, you see, and I saw it said traditional esoteric psychology, so I knew he was one of our lot. And I expected him to do something like the man had done the previous day on the very same spot, another person who, although he looked very much like a red-blooded freedom-loving American, dropped on one knee and said, "Master, bless me." And I said to him, "Well, I'm afraid I don't know how." And he said, "Don't know how?" But he didn't realize, of course, that it was a... depends on what you mean by how. Well, this other chap... this is a story within a story, Arabian Nights style. This other fellow comes up to me, and I brace myself for this question or for the blessing or whatever. Maybe he'll bless me. I'm talking now, of course, about clearing away the undergrowth. He says, "What's your position on busing?" Now, if any of you have been unfortunate enough to read any of the books in which I have isolated some such instances which are used in our teaching, you will immediately see what... this would mean in a sort of Sufi situation. It would mean that this man, although he has got the label of the traditional esoteric psychologies, is preoccupied with something else. Therefore, he's less likely to learn. Now, this other thing, busing, may be much more important. Who's to judge? But he's got his priorities mixed. Something else possesses his mind. And we have many traditional accounts of this in Sufi classical literature, in which it is first necessary to clear the mind, as it were, before one can learn anything. Well, this gentleman with his busing, of course, my crash course in America hadn't actually taken in this busing, so I was a new boy, really, and so, it sounds like English, so I reacted as if it was an English phrase, and busing in England means going somewhere by bus. So, I said to him, "Well, somewhere about the middle." Now, I don't think that pleased him, because he said something like, roughly translatable as, "So you're a bit of a diplomat, eh?" And I couldn't quite understand that. That didn't seem to... I didn't know that diplomats normally went by bus, so I couldn't work the thing out. Until I asked my technical advisors, as it were, and they informed me that busing was something different. So I saw him at the lecture later on, and I was able to put it right. I saw him in the audience, pointed him out, of course, and said, "Well, I gave you the wrong answer, because it wasn't really going in buses. The answer to your question is, I know as much about busing, I'm concerned about it just as much, as you are with Sufism." That's the real answer to that. Now, by this, I don't mean to say that one should be obsessional, or one should be absolutely focused on, motivated by, and dedicated to, but I mean, fair's fair. Give a thing the attention it deserves. That's the first thing we have to do. All right, what do the Sufis aim at? The Sufis aim at an understanding, which can be stated as finding other ways of perceiving the world and a knowledge of things beyond the normal ken, which requires for it to become effective in employment or action in our normal human sphere, to be assessed and evaluated by intellectual capacities which are not ordinarily found in mechanical thought. And if that's too difficult, I think it's both simultaneous and sequential in our double brain format, then you can find many clues in the published materials on how Sufis behave and what they have thought from time to time, and also in the existence of those who are alive and well today. And there are a larger number than you might have thought. Another way of referring to this development, the human development, development of Sufis, of Sufi knowledge, is to say that we say that experiences and perceptions beyond the familiar range are in fact to be gained through what are known as mystical methodologies, both among the Sufis of the Islamic persuasion and elsewhere. There's a great similarity in method and in way of expressing this kind of aim. But Sufism requires both experience and organization. It is not enough for this individual to experience an overweening sense of significance, or of the immensity of things, or the transitory nature of human life, or that he or she has seen reality, or been there and come back. These so-called mystical experiences are well known in almost all cultures. They do not necessarily have a permanent effect. That's why I say that the Sufi's journey involves not only perceiving something, but being able to integrate with it in some sense. So that means there has to be perception and interpretation, or perception and... It's rather difficult to find good words in English, because if I say employment, people say, well, now, yes, you can perceive the divine, for example, but surely you can't employ it. Well, this is only, it's only the poverty of the language which we're using and its relative lack of technical terms in this area which makes it difficult to understand exactly what we mean. So I have to more or less skate round this whole issue, but you'll see what I'm doing as I go on. Now, a Sufi then should be able not only to know what to do, shall we say, but how to do it. He should be able not only to feel love, harmony, brotherhood, as some people put it, but to know what this means. So this places him in a different situation from idealists or from really what you might call good people who base their conduct, beliefs and actions on principles. It makes him respect them even more, because there they are, giving up their lives in many circumstances for something which they believe to be true without any proof that it's true at all. Whereas the Sufi experience gives a sense of truth in why he is doing something, why he should do something or not do something, which seems to him to be of a different order and much more real than his other beliefs, which may be based on conditioning, on traditionalism, on a feeling of goodwill towards humanity, a feeling for justice, and so on. We go so far as to make a distinction between those people who are heroic and those people who have insight. A Sufi will not really be able to serve humanity properly by principle. He'll only be able to serve humanity by experience. So that may have been the case with Teresa of Avila, that she went in the mountains, had the experience, and also had the preparation, also had the organization of mind to know how to serve humanity. In her case, it was social service, uplift the poor, and preaching, and so on. But a Sufi tends to feel that he has functions, I wouldn't say beyond that, but in addition to human service, in addition to ordinary idealism. In fact, you will find in Sufi classics some pretty pungent things said about people who believe that it is a spiritual activity to uplift the poor, to educate the ignorant, to feed the hungry, on the basis that it is the Sufi's contention, certainly of many of our greatest teachers, that these are the minimum basic requirements of humanity, that a human being should be like that. Now, he shouldn't be bribed with paradise or threatened with hell for that. That is his duty. And to inflate it into some kind of a spiritual act should at best only be done at the lowest level. That is to say, when you are getting people from a stage of savagery or equivalent into a state of morality, in whatever sense you use the word. Beyond that is the stage in which you can really serve humanity. Luckily, unlike the members of some metaphysical but not perhaps spiritual in our sense traditions, so far we don't find any conflict between the morality we find as a general consensus morality among humanity and that which the Sufis believe to be derived from a direct perception of truth. Now, Sufi, it's one of those words. I say Sufi. All right. Now, as soon as you hear or see this word, what associations does it conjure up? This will tend to depend on your experiences with it, with what's supposed to be Sufi. Or look up dictionaries and you pay your money and you take your pick. I mean, it's either a Mohammedan mystic whirling dervish or member of a metaphysical order or something. Most of these things are roughly accurate and also very roughly inaccurate about what a Sufi is. A lot of people are imitators, of course, but we'll come to them in a minute. Now, I prefer the definition of Ali al-Hujwiri writing the first Persian book on Sufism. And in this he says, this is the first book in Persian written on Sufism, Kashf al-Mahjub, Revelation of the Veiled. And he says there, Sufism was formerly a reality without a name. Today it is a name without a reality. And that was the first extant book in Persian on Sufism. And he said that centuries before, many of the great Sufi classics and what are called textbooks were written by such great authorities as Ibn al-Arabi of Spain, whom we call Sheikh al-Akbar, the greatest master, translated in the Middle Ages, by the way. I rather like the way the schoolmen translated it into Latin as Dr. Maximus, Sheikh al-Akbar, the great teacher, then al-Ghazali of Persia, and Rumi of what is Afghanistan now, my own neck of the woods. But nevertheless, that wasn't just a commercial, he was one of our very greatest. Now, if the object of Sufism is to become a Sufi, to reach a certain kind of understanding of things which I might have to call in celebrated companies such as this, by such a word as extra-dimensional cognition, and if the goal has been reached, and the way to retrace this path is known to living people, and if some at least of these living people are engaged, though not necessarily exclusively, in enabling others to tread this path, certain differences between Sufi action on the one hand, Sufi thought and action on the one hand, and more familiar esoteric systems on the other, do, I say, immediately become apparent. Now, perhaps the most noteworthy of these differences is that the development and applications of Sufism as a study will, if you examine the documents, you can see it, but you can listen to me, it's much easier because it requires a number of languages, however, will show that the Sufi exponent, whom we will call by many names, I'm calling him an exponent because this word isn't used very much now, he organizes and projects his teaching in a manner consistent with his experience primarily and not primarily consistent with a doctrine. If the two concur, well and good. Certainly not in accordance with a dogma. Now, many academics have tied themselves in knots. It's called in England getting your knickers in a twist over this problem. Because in order to prove that Sufism is what they want to prove it to be, which is one of the academic pastimes among some Orientalists, they have to exclude a lot of very reliable material on the grounds that it's not relevant or not typical. And they generally arrive at one or other of several interpretations which tend to cancel one another out. I'll go back to that in a minute. So first, this man, we have to start somewhere, this man or woman who is a Sufi has had an experience called a mystical experience, has to find out how to express this, may want to teach it, may teach it, I don't say want to, may teach it. In order to teach it, you have to work out how to teach it. You can only work out how to teach it in accordance with the peculiarities of your students. Not by speaking into a void, just Sufism is this and that and the other. A lot of jokes about this you'll find in Mullah Nasruddin books and so on. But, and also, you must adapt it to prevailing circumstances. There are cases of Sufi books which, some of them well known, which don't contain the word God, which are love poetry. And people have been had up by inquisitions for that. But the fact is that it is the formulation does not have to follow a prevailing dogma. And for that we have the word of Ibn Arabi, our greatest teacher, Dr. Maximus. Now take the familiar type of teaching organization that we use for learning other things. It has a stock of information, a body of knowledge. It's got tested methods. It's got its teaching staff, and it's got students of a certain capacity. If they aren't of that capacity, then they don't stay in it, so we can assume they are students of a certain capacity. Now, this teaching institution, which you would call a university or a school, college, and so on, will seek to bring these factors together in such a manner as is familiar to all of us. We know how they do it, we know what they do, and we know why we go there and why they give us these bits of paper and so on. But for the Sufi, the world is not at all static, and the knowledge to be imparted is not formal or factual, very seldom. And if it is, it's generally for transitional purposes. It's not just something which you memorize and reproduce on a bit of paper and you get paid for it. So the student certainly is not a pitcher to be filled or a piece of wood to be whittled or a bit of material to be processed. And I know that many modern Western teaching institutions claim that they don't process people either, but God knows. So really what the Sufi is doing is trying to convey, if he is trying to convey it, and not all of them are, something like a skill rather than a practical activity which you can apply. I suppose that much is fairly well understood by people who've read at all in this area, but it's worth saying again, because people tend to try to learn Sufism by rote, or to try to learn it by experience alone, shall we say. They don't realize that it involves a sort of discipline which is not a form of slavery, but nevertheless has some kind of limits, borders, parameters, and these sort of words they use nowadays for these things. So the Sufi who is teaching is someone who is imparting something, as it were, moment to moment, in accordance with how things are, in some rather difficult to explain manner. Sometimes he can teach, sometimes he can't. Sometimes one can learn, sometimes one can't learn from him. So he structures his method. His method may appear to be very similar to that of others, or may appear to be very different, but he structures it just the same in accordance with what his audience is. And that's why people learning in Sufism have to be prepared for this peculiarity. The only similarity to this peculiarity that I have found in the West is with artists and people who are considered to be slightly eccentric, and they say, oh, well, you know, he's a great maestro, but sometimes he doesn't want to teach, or sometimes the power has gone out of his fingers, or whatever it is. That's the sort of thing. And there is no, as far as I know, no computer which can replace this Sufi just yet. Now, if you look at Sufi literature, including much of the poetry, and even what appears to be a theological exegesis, you'll find that this sense of Sufi thought and action, this sense that it is not really possible to crystallize it, is a matter of very urgent concern to Sufis. They find it necessary to try to convey and maintain this idea of flexibility of approach in their hearers. So, it's been said to me, for example, regarding the conventional method of learning and characteristics of study, that instruction is information, training, and the development of abilities in the student. This is one thing which many people have said to me. I have extracted that from a large number of definitions of what education is, if you like. And the Sufi says, we help to impart Sufi capacity whether or not this involves instruction, information, training, and development. Our role is not to impress or mystify or to insist on certain acts or beliefs or even on the reaching of quantifiable goals or even to make sure that certain ideals are maintained as a part of Sufi learning. They may have to be maintained as a part of environmental stability, in the sense that if you don't have a structure in which to live and work, then you probably can't learn something of a higher nature, because you haven't got whatever it means. You've got civil strife, or you've got no food, or you're all confused. You must have some kind of stability from which to operate. But Sufism isn't trying to establish that stability. It is trying to work beyond it. So what a Sufi says and what he does is always subordinate to and commanded by his perception of what the learner needs at any given time or place and under prevailing circumstances. That's why there are many proverbs to this effect. Now, Sufi is trying to arrive at extra-dimensional perceptions for various reasons, usually of a religious nature. Very good. Now, many people, and I don't mind saying this on my own responsibility because it's a product of my own experience, don't really want to learn about Sufism at all. There's a slight misunderstanding between us. They want all kinds of things, which we very often find out in interviews with them if they get that far. Mostly they don't. I mean, I get mail from the United States. Since I have your sympathetic ear and you look much more kindly disposed towards me than I had feared, I will dare to tell you that I have on file more than one letter, I think quite a number of letters, which say almost exactly these words from the United States. Please send me the name and address of my enfranchised neighborhood Sufi teacher. Now, even if I translate that into the sort of English, degenerate English, and find out what the word enfranchised means, which isn't very current in Britain, it's still rather baffling to know from where did these people obtain this model of how Sufis are organized. That's a very interesting thing. I mean, it can't be just what is called pig ignorant in England. I mean, there must be some little man with a little turban in some little cave in the Catskill Mountains or something saying there are neighborhood enfranchised Sufi teachers or something. This is not the kind of thing that arises spontaneously, I should hope. But anyway, this is something in the nature of a recreation to wonder this, because in fact it comes under clear away the brushwood, you know. You have to clear away this brushwood. So people don't want to learn because they think they want to learn something else. They're trying to learn something other than something which you might be able to help them with. Therefore, we do have this spirituality of the West, as Dr. Ornstein has called it. We have this, perhaps an Eastern fanatic might call some evidence that the West is spiritually disadvantaged, rather as we in the East are materially disadvantaged or technologically disadvantaged, that there is a certain, perhaps, as I say, I wouldn't say it, but thousands would, that this there seems to be some sort of a primitivity here which needs a little bit of work on it before we can find out what's going on. Well, I will admit that in the 13th century, Jalaluddin Rumi said that the Sufi is made wise by the truth. He is not a scholar from a book. And some of you may have heard that I have, as it were, written some books. I think you call it authored a book here. Well, I prefer to call it authored because, as you know, I have done hardly any original work in print. Mostly I have been content to give you much better material, which other people have done, but I've been a kind of channel for it. So I've authored some stuff, and people write to me regularly saying, or they come and say this, I don't want to learn from books. They express great surprise when I say to them, well, you're sort of nice, clean living, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants or whatever, and I'm only a poor, whatever is your equivalent here, wetback or something, and my crash course. But in my part of the world, where we're not all that logical, we are the right hemisphere people, really, we are taught that when you go to the West, you've got to be logical. These people think straight. All right, so we work and work and work and work to think straight. Then we've got it. We can think straight. So we say, right, now, here I am thinking straight. Now, straight thinking includes not coming, in my book, includes not going to a man who writes books and telling him you don't want to read books. So that's what I call people who don't really want to know. They don't really want to know. And that's partly, I think, because visiting people and spirituality, metaphysics, and the quest for knowledge and so on really comes under the entertainment industry in some parts of the world. And in the East, too, very much. The only difference is that some of us, shall we say, we've got various branches of metaphysics, and only one is the entertainment industry. Still, whatever turns you on. So the difficulty, where we are exactly, is this. In the East, we have what I am calling secondary, lower-level stabilizations of the study and action of Sufism, like water finding its own level, which means that we have people who study Sufism as academics, and they think that it must be studied academically, and they have, in our definition, stabilized it at that level, or in that particular corner. Then there are people who organize cults and jump up and down and say funny things, and they have stabilized it on that, if stability it be. And we have these people in the East as well, but we've got names for them, which aren't the same as your names at all. Because people in the East are supposed to be polite, but they're not really, you know, half as polite as you are. You're very nice people. What happens, of course, is that when somebody stands up, say like me, and says, I want to clear away the brushwood, I want to give you indications of this Sufism which will connect with your existing institutions, with your psychology, with your sociology, with your idea of spirituality, with your cultural institutions, with your literature, then I come up against the vested interests, of course, the people who jump up and down, and they both jump up and down, of course, when I, terribly, I mean, the ones who've been men of the pen, as we call it, become men of the tongue, and publish such exciting things as a letter I saw to the editor of a paper before I left England a little while ago, in which a celebrated scholar has, under his own name, signed a letter saying that I couldn't possibly be a spiritual man, that's me, because he's counted the number of times I use the word God, and it's very, very seldom. So that's what we're up against. Now, he is a man who thinks he works in Sufism, he thinks he knows Sufism, he thinks I don't. Well, what I am aiming for is to help make available to you the whole range of this stuff. Now, the academics, as they are called, some people call them, can look after themselves, and so can the esotericists, you know. Now, a large number of things which we do in the West, like, for example, mimetic behavior, people also do in the East. But when you're trying to introduce a certain sort of study, this mimetic behavior of relating to irrelevances, copying people's actions or words and so on, can become counterproductive. I remember hearing that at one time it was not possible to carry out the sacred act of distillation without saying a certain number of Ave Marias, because otherwise it wouldn't work. That was when you were a certain kind of alchemist. When that particular restriction was lifted or broken through, chemistry came into being. We have mimetic behavior in this dervish exercises. We have mental exercises, we have physical exercises, we have exercises like you have not got fleas, I hope. We have. But this kind of frenetic and mimetic behavior will operate only as an area of the entertainment industry, as it were, something which will help you to discharge your anxieties. And if that's what it's for, fine. But you must allow those people who have other descriptions for it and other ways of studying this subject to do so in those ways. This mimetic behavior is very mysterious. I think it's something which you could well study, those of you who are sociologists, because I think it tends to produce conditions of mind which are undesirable. I remember a woman coming to the house and talking to me once, and I said to her, won't you smoke? And a few weeks later she telephoned me and said, I'm up to 50 a day. What do I do now? This is true. So in the study of Sufism, you must remember that Sufism is participation. That is to say, Sufism is something experienced. It's not something read about. On the other hand, there is an instrumental role to literature. And that's not... The informational role of literature is very secondary, but the instrumental role is there as part of the experience. But this is something which has to be said, because people in the West, as people in the East, tend to imagine that one kind of question has the same sort of answer as another kind of question. How high is that building and how can I get higher consciousness? But so somebody said to me the other day, and I thought it was very true, a Sufi said about the study, how you study things. He says, an Egyptologist collects and organizes information, and a reincarnationist may be positive that he feels within him his past in, say, ancient Egypt, but no Egyptologist will ever become a pharaoh. And neither will the believer in reincarnation ever have any of the actual knowledge which a Nilotic peasant has. So Sufism has its own method of study, or methods of study. It is its own sort of thing. It's not unique. It's not really unique, but it is, for instance, as I am interested in and involved in it, it's the thing that I am answerable for and to. So I'm not a comparative student, as it were. For all I know, there are a million other things like Sufism or better than it, but I don't discuss this because I am like a carpenter working away at my own job. But if by Sufi definition, and surely we must listen to this definition if we listen to anything it says, not just reading and studying selectively, the real development of Sufism and its applications are not to be found in academic work or in random or uninstructed experimentation, because Sufism is caught just as much as it's taught. And if Sufism is to be, as it were, absorbed by such a judicious process as might be found in another range, in the working of a master of an art, rather than a profession. What about the participation that many people at present think they enjoy in Sufi activities, current so-called Sufi activities? I only have to say this about it, that since this material is coming more and more onto the market, since interest in Sufism is developing, since more and more literature is pouring into the bookstores, I recommend you, if you are interested in this problem at all, to read that literature, no matter who writes it. There's enough stuff coming out now for you to be able to judge quite easily the difference between a raving lunatic and the rest. So, as long as you do not restrict your intake of information to any one channel, what I tell you, for example, then you will be able to form a reasonable opinion on this material. And I'm quite prepared to take my chance with all the other literature and activities available in this way. So what I am really trying to do is to give you some sort of parameters, as it were. A lot of people will do mystical exercises given to them by Sufis, supposedly, because they do not know that there's any other explanation for these exercises. There is an Arabic proverb which says, not every round object is a cake. And it is my hope that if you are interested in this subject for itself, or for familiarization, or for its potential in relating itself or its spin-off byproducts to the mainstream of Western culture, in any of its forms, that you familiarize yourself with enough about this subject, which you can get at bookstores and probably from libraries, in order to see which of the round things is a cake. I must tell you that one of the severe disabilities in approaching Sufi study is that one doesn't really get very far in I nearly said authentic, but I'll just not say that in case it sounds like an exaggeration in Sufi circles. But if one has fixed beliefs or commitments of a type which indicate a prejudiced sort of mind, this is a very difficult thing to get round to, but certain sorts of prejudices are effectively the substitute in our book for learning. In other words, lots of people who don't want to learn are prejudiced instead. And this may be your own experience in other areas. I refer here to a very prominent British metaphysician, so many of you will have heard of, but still, who used to beg me to give him the address of some Sufis in the Middle East. And finally, I sent him to some friends of mine in a country there. And he was shown into this room where all these old boys were sitting around with a hubble-bubble pipe. And they had this water pipe. And they passed the sort of unhygienic pipe stem from one to the other. And the room was full of smoke. And this man, who was a non-smoker, anti-smoker, began to cough and splutter. And he began to sort of indicate that he didn't feel very happy there. And they said to him, "Have a smoke, sit down, have a smoke." Well, he said, "No, I've never smoked in my life, and neither would I. And I think smoking is all wrong." And so they immediately called a couple of farashis, porters, and had him flung out. And he came back to England. Now, I'm not trying to advocate smoking, but this kind of attitude towards it is rather, if your feeling about something is so strong that it inhibits your connecting with something else because of it, then you won't get anywhere in Sufism except in the areas which are academic or so-called experiential, of the twisting and twirling and shouting and roaring and all those things, which you can get anywhere. You don't have to go to Sufism for that. All right, now let's start again. What is the brief theory of Sufism? Who are the past and present authorities on the subject? What are the standard books? How is it organized? What does it promise? How long will it take me to get there? What do I pay and how soon can I join? These are the main questions which I've collected from some tens of thousands of letters from people who have got hold of my address. I have 40,000 letters, odd letters on file, very odd letters. And since we're in America, I'm trying to quantify things, as you notice. I hope you appreciate my statistical capacity. And I've discussed these matters with getting on for 20,000 people, although I avoid it as much as possible. And I have about 20 conversations a week and roughly 30 to 50 letters on these general subjects every day, apart from my hate mail and all the rest. Somebody asked me if I can refer to some kind of a real Sufi situation which exists between people, a Sufi and somebody who isn't a Sufi, wants to be. I can tell you that what frequently happens is somebody asks a question. It doesn't have to be how can I become rich and famous or whatever, although we get those too, but it's a question like, how long will it take? Now, that tells you something straight away about that person, that he's thinking in terms of time. He maybe has only got 5 minutes between trains or something. A fellow once said to me, "I am working for my DPhil, Doctorate of Philosophy at Oxford. If I get it, I can become the head of the BBC in London. What can you offer me if I go through your course?" Well, you can't say fairer than that, as they say. I mean, here's a man who knows his own mind and he's able to weigh up the alternatives. Now, he was quite an intelligent man and quite a reasonable person. But due to some peculiarity, defect in his upbringing, or his grandmother bit him when he was in the womb, or whatever you say, he had failed to observe that there is only one Director General of the BBC, and there are 80,000 DPhils of Oxford, and some of those DPhils are actually running hamburger joints in Piccadilly Circus. And I told him that, and he was very disappointed. Now, this told me something about him, then it told him something about me, and it also told him what I thought about him. All right? So we're getting on. We are getting somewhere. So if, however, he breaks off at this point and gets enraged, or I get infuriated with him because he's the 20,952nd person who's asked me that question, then it's no contest. You see, things goes wrong. Nothing has happened, really. What's happened is it didn't work. I fell down on the job, so did he, sort of thing. But from that point, we can go further. And with a further position, which, believe it or not, for those of you who are not as obsessed by Sufism as I am, is connected with the expansion of human consciousness, the further point to which we are going enables us to ask and answer the kind of questions which are more effective in helping me or whoever is teaching him to develop my understanding of his problems, and he in turn to develop the capacity to, if you like, produce more productive problems. This is the process. You see this in Sufi stories. In the case of meetings between people who are Sufis and people who aren't, you see in the live situation, you see this sort of thing happening. It tends to be a bit alien, I believe, to your traditions. The reason for it is this, that your traditions are strongly influenced, I think, by a rather more lucid Greek tradition of thought, that if I help you to think straighter than you thought before, then end of contest. Well, that's really very useful. That's what used to be called a part of philosophy, but since philosophy is supposed to mean love of wisdom, and I call that a love of clear thinking, we have slight adjustments to make if we are to interpolate, as it were, into your culture a way of behaving which helps a person to become more aware, more capable, and more fulfilled, more rounded out, rather than just better at wisecracks, or, which is probably worse, terribly submitted, you know, crushed, yes, beat me again, master, sort of thing. In the West, there is a danger of these two things. One finds it again and again and again, that people learn to be very sharp-witted. They hone their wits on you. And they're able to answer you back, as it were, to such a point. They get to the point when you can't answer them at all because they're too good at it. They have perfected the Sufi interchange on a wisecrack basis. They have sophisticated it out of all developmental capacity. It's rather like you might say they have sharpened a screwdriver until it's only a point and will not drive screws in anymore. Then there's the other type who wish only, we could say sort of dog without a master, desire only to have someone or something to which or to whom to submit. And these are two very, very common responses in Western people. Now, I'm not objecting to these responses, but I'm saying, of course, we are all capable of many other responses. In order for this process to continue, this process of learning about Sufism and learning in Sufism as well as of Sufism, one needs, in addition to illustrative literature, one needs situations. I'll say more about situations in a moment. I have to say with great reserve, or with apologies, although it is true, that people who approach us with these sort of lists of questions, who is the boss, what's the literature, what do I do, how much do I pay, when does it happen, how long will it take, what do I eat, what do I not eat, these people tend to be not susceptible, if that's the right word, to our impact, for better or worse. In other words, they're really looking for something else. They're not looking for the sort of thing which we are doing. I'm not saying it's wrong or bad or superficial even, but they are different. Their mental set is different. Although their mental set is different, they are able to acquire another mental set, not at the expense of this one, but to build in, as it were, another one by familiarizing themselves with published literature on Sufism. In other words, the sort of questions that people didn't answer or answered in some other way or were considered inadmissible. They can get this from published literature. They don't have to attend meetings. They can prepare themselves, as it were, to benefit from meetings, because very sadly, I find that many of the people whom I meet and my associates meet, who are desperate to meet you, to see you, to learn from you, to learn about you, to do this thing and so on, tend to be only very feebly prepared for this, to put it no higher. This preparation is done by means of examining the information available on this subject from various points of view, getting to know about the information. Now, in many Middle Eastern countries, if not most of those countries, We don't have this problem. The reason is, of course, that there is a cultural tradition, a general cultural tradition, which has caused the mental exercises to the ability to switch to different points of view on the same material to be naturalized into the literature. So, for example, we only have one in Persian, one major classic, Shahnameh of Firdowsi, the Book of Kings, which was not written by a Sufi, and yet that Persian literature is one of the greatest literatures in the world. By reading that literature, a person familiarizes himself with the points of view and the culture, you might almost call it, of the Sufis, which enables them to ask the kind of questions which in turn makes it possible to teach them. In the West, we have to lay down our own compost, as it were. We have to lay down our own preparation for this, because it isn't easy to find, this kind of mental set or flexibility of mind. It is, on the other hand, very easy to find people who will do anything you say or refuse to do anything you say or take you or leave you or whatever. These extremes are very easy to find. But there is a middle ground.